That's Miles Davis and his All-Stars with Walkin'. Recorded in 1954, incidentally. Miles Davis on trumpet, Lucky Thompson, tenor sax, J.J. Johnson on trombone, Horace Silva, piano, Percy Heath on bass, and Clenny Clark on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, November the 25th. And on the heels of a deal the United States has struck with Iran to limit its nuclear program in exchange for a partial lifting of economic sanctions, Saudi Arabia, the dominant political power in the Gulf region, says the United States and its Western allies lied and hid information about its negotiations, and so Saudi Arabia will now pursue its own foreign policy agenda. Israel immediately condemned the agreement, calling it a historic mistake, and criticism is heating up at home. Ex-CIA Director General Michael Hayden has called the deal the worst possible outcome, and U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York predicts legislator defections from the Democratic Party. We begin our program today again focusing our attention on Detroit, where any day now, Judge Stephen Rhodes will decide whether the city can declare bankruptcy. We start off with the author of a scathing report released last week that said Wall Street, poor governmental decisions, and the recession, not city workers' and retirees' pensions, are the main reasons for Detroit's fiscal crisis. And worse, the emergency manager appointed to take over the city's operations has deliberately exaggerated Detroit's debt in order to push for bankruptcy. Wallace Turberville is a senior fellow at Demos, a Manhattan-based public policy think tank, and he joins us now. Thank you, sir, for being with us today.
Thanks for so much for having me.
Great. So let's tackle the second part first. Is the city of Detroit actually exaggerating its debt in order to push for bankruptcy? And if so, what's the advantage of doing that?
Well, I think it's the real advantage is from a public perception perspective. I think that if you there's every story that you read in the press, every utterance is starts with City of Detroit $18 billion in debt, and that's I think it's as much as anything a public relations effort, and it's clear that what's happened is that the emergency manager has mixed apples and oranges and actually just misled folks on a lot of this debt to get to a number that's as high as possible, because it's hoped to make life easier for him to get what he wants to do done.
Well, I was happy to read the report. It's quite comprehensive and really startling. But I was also puzzled as to why I would have imagined that somebody other than you, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but somebody other than you, considering that this matter has gone to court, would have done an independent study. How come?
I think a lot of it has to do with resources. The folks that are going to be individuals that are going to be harmed if pensions, for instance, get cut and healthcare benefits get cut, they don't have a lot of resources. On the other hand, the city of Detroit, believe it or not, seems to have enough resources to pay law firms. One law firm, I believe, has been paid something like $11 million. I mean, the total legal cost so far is something like $22 million. And it's very hard for the other folks to sort of the muster the resources to get people to look at it. I had a particular interest in it. I've worked for the city of Detroit. I was a municipal bond lawyer. I was a municipal banker at Goldman Sachs for a number of years. So I had sort of a basic set of experiences that help, but there's otherwise without me you would have to pay a lot of money. So that's the problem.
Well, that's a good lead in to the question about Wall Street. You say in the report that Wall Street banks are a huge part of the problem. In what way?
Well, to some extent, the city has paid out a lot in costs of financings that it's done, but it's really the situation that the city finds it in now, in terms of some very bad things that might happen. In other words, the fact that they might end up paying a lot of money to Wall Street because of these really complex derivatives transactions makes it much more difficult to manage their circumstances to pay the bills as they come due, just for regular bills. The city ended up doing a very complex the total deal was something like $1.5 billion, but the half of it was really, really complex because it was tied to a derivative in 2005, 2006. And what's happened is that whole thing has been terminated by the banks, which, you know, they had in the documents, they had the right to do that. But they're claiming somewhere between $250 and $350 million, literally $350 million. They might reduce it some. But the city just – that puts the city in some very, very difficult circumstances. And they shouldn't have gotten into that deal. And, you know, it's one of those things, if the city wanted to, the bank should have known better. It was too – far too likely to have dire consequences for the city.
Is that an actionable issue, that the banks doing something along with the city government, who that was then the former Mayor Kilpatrick, who has since then been sentenced to prison for fraud and other charges? But is that an actionable issue, that they did this deal knowing that the city had to do very unusual things to accommodate the banks and the banks' interests? So is that an actionable item?
Well, the it has the feel of being unethical. In fact, I would say it was basically unethical. Whether that translates into a legal consequence or not is, you know, I'm not in a position to say. I did practice law for a while, but I'm not a practicing lawyer and I'm not a judge. So I will say this. It certainly should be part of the discussion, which means that the negotiating leverage. I mean, every insolvency has negotiations as things get restructured. The focus should be very heavily on these financial transactions because of the fact that they are questionable, and whether that actually has a legal consequence or not, I'm just not in a position to know. But I know it should. Whether it actually does or not is another issue.
Now, the $118 billion figure has been the standard reference point for Detroit's fiscal woes. I mean, even I have been quoting it. Most media, everybody's taking for granted what the city says, that
yes.
$18 billion in debt.
Right.
If $18 billion is not the real debt, what is the real debt, according to you?
Well, that's the part of the problem is that that's a tough question. There's a couple of billion dollars that's truly debt. And unquestionably debt. Then you have the other thing that's described as debt is the potential for having to, in the future, put money into the pension fund, which is an estimate. There's a similar number for the amount in the future that might be paid out in health care benefits for retirees and active workers. The two of those together come close to $10 billion. I mean, according to the figures that have been used by the emergency manager. The problem with that is you don't actually know. Those are just estimates based on lots of different assumptions. It has a lot to do with where is the stock market going to go over the next 30 years, which, you know, who knows that. So part of the problem is how do you define debt? And what I would suggest is to is to not try to lump it all together because it gets to a politically convenient number, but actually just look at the different things that the city has to do in the future and try to make a good judgment about those. And the problem is that the emergency manager has used a lot of assumptions that have pumped those estimates up, and they aren't necessarily, it's not like there's an absolute truth. There's no religious outcome here that this is the truth. They're all just assumptions, and it's just not useful to try to lump them all together to create a big number.
So we have Wall Street making very dicey decisions with the consent and participation of the then mayor in the years 2005, 2006. We have an overestimation, you say, of the actual debt of the city. And the third, you say, is the recession that affected the entire country, but particularly Detroit. It had a pretty tough time with the recession. What was the impact of the recession on Detroit's tax revenues?
Detroit's tax base suffered a crushing blow. What happened as the Great Recession set in Detroit was devastating. Detroit's been on a long-term decline. There have been things about it that, population's been decreasing. It was sort of the centerpiece of industrial America for a while. But so over a 20-year period, the number of people actually working in Detroit. So it's an interesting figure is how many people are actually working, right? So the government draws its resources from people who are at work. Over the last 20 years, that number has actually gone down by 53%, in part because people have moved out, in part because the economy's performed poorly. But half of that occurred in 2008. And so what happened was that the jobs just fled Detroit at that point, and it was much harsher for Detroit than for other cities, certainly any of the big Midwestern cities and any of the big cities at all. And so what that meant was that the tax base declined as income taxes and real estate taxes plummeted. So the whole tax revenues side fell by 20%, which is a tremendously large number. And so that was a tremendously harsh effect on the city of Detroit, and caught them in this cash flow squeeze because they were trying to keep up by they cut operating budgets by 38%, and it makes sense, right? If you lose revenues of 20, then half of your outflow is operating, so you try to cut the part that you can actually make adjustments to, and they couldn't keep up with it. And then what happened is at the very end, the state of Michigan cut revenue sharing generally, and in particular in Detroit, and that had like a $44 million hit in 1 year, and that's really what tipped them to the point of just not being able to right the ship.
As things stand now, what is a reasonable way out for Detroit from the clutches of bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think starting with what is an unreasonable way out is to, I mean, the right now, worker salaries and benefits are meager. I mean, they've cut for a number of years. And like I said, the operating expenses have gone down 38%. So a lot of what you read about Detroit, really people should interpret it like, you know, the streetlights don't work. It takes a long time to get police to a crime scene. A lot of things just don't work. And part of the reason they don't work is the major part of the reason they don't work is they've been cutting everything like crazy since 2008. So I think to focus on anything that cut further, as the emergency manager wishes to do, especially benefits, is really counterproductive, because what they have to do actually is attract more workers and get to a position where they've righted the ship and have got, you know, can actually pay their bills, and then improve services so as to improve the tax base. So I conclude that the only way really to practically make it work in a way that actually sets the city up for success is that somehow the revenue side has to be addressed. That tremendous hit to the revenue side has to be addressed and recognize it really isn't a spending problem, it's a revenue problem in the city of Detroit.
Are you satisfied with the response of the federal government to Detroit's position?
Well, the federal government's done a couple of things recently. They did. There is a promise of some development money. This is not going to help in terms of the bankruptcy, which is they're just out of cash, right? So nobody, the federal government hasn't suggested that they're going to write a check for cash. But they have said they would provide some development money. And the other element that is in the J.P. Morgan Chase settlement on the mortgage situation, the $13 billion settlement, about $4 billion of that is designated for urban areas particularly devastated by mortgages. And I'm pretty sure that some of the people who have underwater mortgages in the city of Detroit are going to get something out of that. So that's all to the good. When you say satisfied, it would be in the nation's interest to make them to put some cash up to help them out. But that is something that the federal government has a hard time doing at this point. Who really should be doing it is the state of Michigan, who has plenty of room in terms of their taxing capacity and their borrowing capacity, that really should be coming in to try to keep the bills paid for a period of time on an emergency basis, so that its largest city by far, can actually return to vitality and to become a really great and vital place again. So the real responsibility should be with the state.
Finally, I wanted to ask whether your report has been submitted to the court for consideration, as Stephen Rose, the judge, bankruptcy judge, is determining the future of Detroit. Has your report been submitted to the court?
I have no knowledge of whether it has or not. I would hope that at least some of the data and some of the interpretation would find its way in that direction. Of course, where the court is now is that it's got to make a ruling that determines whether the city of Detroit is indeed bankrupt, and they're going to take jurisdiction under the federal bankruptcy code, and that's the very next thing that's going to happen. If indeed the court takes jurisdiction and the bankruptcy continues, then I think there'll be lots of discussion about how to approach different categories of payments that the city has to make, and I think it'll be more useful as it moves through that.
Well, Wallace Durbeville, thank you so much for being with us today and bringing this to our attention. I will now use the $18 billion quote very, very carefully.
That would be a good idea. I think we all got a little bit misled on that one.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there you go. You, as they say, you live, you learn. And this is a report that came out just last week. It is very, very, very instructive. If you want to know more about it, go to www.demos.org/publication/Detroit-bankruptcy. Okay, that's gives you the report in its entirety, and it's worth looking at because it is very, very insightful. I want to talk next about President Obama's nuclear trade bomb, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And joining me is Liz Warren. Liz Warren is a regional organizer for Move On, and she's with us right now. Thank you, Liz, for being with us today.
Thanks, Yatrice.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Thanks so much. Well, tell us about this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Give us a we're doing a primer today. What is the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Okay, well, just in the broad strokes, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade agreement, or it's identified as a trade agreement, and it's identified as a free trade agreement. It's similar to NAFTA, which a lot of folks may remember, and the WTO talks, which I think people might remember from being in the news. It is, you know, basically pushed by the president and the trade representative as something that would open up new markets for U.S. Manufacturers and bring jobs home and do all kinds of great kinds of economic stimulus for us. It has 29 chapters to it. It has been in negotiation for almost 5 years now. It's in its 20th round beginning December 7th, in fact, in Singapore. It involves a total of 12 countries, including the U.S. and a number of Pacific Rim countries, plus Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And of the 29 chapters, only five actually deal with trade. The rest of them are what most of us who've been working on it call corporate giveaways or corporate end runs around regulations that they couldn't otherwise get, so they're burying them in this trade negotiation. The interesting thing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and what makes it really unique is that it's the only trade agreement in U.S. history which has had the negotiating text classified by the president as secret. That is correct. You heard right. It is classified secret. No citizen in the United States is legally allowed to see what is in the negotiating text of this trade agreement that would have broad and lasting effect on our lives in many, many ways. Up until this year, in fact, members of Congress weren't even allowed to see it. And that includes the members of Congress in the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade and the Senate Finance Committee overseeing trade. And these are, you know, houses of Congress that actually have constitutional authority over trade. So keep this in mind. The president, the U.S. trade representative, Michael Froman, who is the new trade representative this year, the previous one was named Ron Kirk, and I'll mention a little bit about him in a minute. They, along with 600 what they call trade advisors, which are, you know, primarily corporate entities, there's a couple of non-governmental organizations that are allowed to weigh in, but they don't really have voting rights or anything. But they're also sworn to secrecy, so even if they can listen in, they can't tell anybody about what they're hearing. So they're present. But the folks that are actually feeding into the content and overseeing what types of things we're asking other countries to make deals on are corporations. And that's kind of an interesting thing when you think about it. You know, we didn't elect them. They're not making us privy to what they're doing, but they're going to be trying to push through something that we will have to live with indefinitely because it has what is called a docking provision in it. What that is something that basically says this is the gold standard, this is the standard of trade. You know, we've established it between these major trading partners. And any new countries who then want to trade have to join under these terms. Part of the reason the United States has been pushing this so hard is to make deals with all of the other Pacific Rim countries and kind of leave China by itself over in the corner. And there's been a lot of controversy over Chinese imports, but, you know, rather than dealing with it in different ways, the U.S. has decided that it wants to push through this trade agreement. The other thing that is happening at the same time is that we are also negotiating a similar version of this trade agreement with countries in Europe, called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. That agreement had been referred to as CAFTA for a while because it was originally called the Transatlantic Free Trade Area. but the president actually changed the name, I think, because people were relating it too closely to NAFTA, which we all know was pretty bad. It actually destroyed Mexico's economy, contributed to what, a lot of folks are upset about, an influx of, poor immigrants coming over the border looking for work because they couldn't feed themselves where they were living because we destroyed their economy. So we're looking at doing the same thing worldwide.
Okay. Let me ask about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because this has been going on for some time. People have been zipping all over the world, engaging in talks. You were correct about the fact that this is secret, pretty much like the way the Affordable Care Act got its start, in total secrecy. So it's following that pattern. But the House, technically, it's Congress that approves all trade agreements. Now, if this is done in secret, to the point where even members of Congress don't know the details, the actual content of the trade agreements that are being struck, or even the discussions that are being had, it is now being pushed very heavily on what is known as the fast track, which is, could you explain what the tactic is here by the Obama administration to get whatever it is they have concocted as a trade agreement with these 12 governments? Could you explain what the fast tracking is, and what is the goal of fast tracking the secret pact?
Sure, be glad to. Fast track is sort of a nickname. It's for something that they call Trade Promotion Authority. Okay, let me back up. Constitutionally, Congress is the branch of government that actually has legal authority to approve trade agreements. It is not with the executive branch. So the president does not have constitutional authority to approve trade agreements. Congress does. Fast track was something that was contrived during the Nixon administration as a way of kind of bypassing, some of the more complex approval processes that Congress would put, trade agreements through. The idea was that a president could go and meet with, heads of state and make deals, and those other heads of state could then be confident that the deal they make was going to be approved. That is something that's only been used a handful of times and always for trade agreements that are sort of suspect. What happens when fast track approval or trade promotion authority, as they called it sort of euphemistically, is passed, is that Congress actually gives authority to the president. Congress actually takes a vote and cedes authority to negotiate to the president. They then agree that they will not amend the trade agreement when it comes back, so the president can actually negotiate along with the trade representative and any of his advisors, all the details of a trade agreement, bring it back to Congress where they may not amend it. They're only allowed 20 hours of debate, and they have a very specific period of time in which both houses of Congress then have to, vote it up or down. And, the people say, well, Congress does still need to vote on it. Yes, they do. But bear in mind that they're going to be voting sort of under duress. For one thing, they won't have really had time to sufficiently review something that is thousands and thousands of pages. Even though they are actually technically given access now, what they have to do is go sit in a room under guard. They may not take notes or make photocopies or bring along a staffer or do anything to sort of record what they're reading about this trade agreement. So they sort of have to come in, and unless they've taken the Evelyn Wood course, in reading dynamics, they have to commit to memory, everything that they see in these thousands of pages and all of the details, which I don't know anybody who can do that. So they make it functionally impossible for Congress to really be aware of every detail when they're being asked to vote on this. So that's kind of a, big red flag, I think, for most people. And so the way that they're trying to push it through would be very problematic. You're asking Congress, which has authority, to cede authority to the president, and further to then vote on something without benefit of being fully informed about what they're voting on. And, you know, we can get into some of the details of what we know about it in a minute, but just that very fact is sort of contradictory to the democratic process. It puts too much emphasis on the executive branch. It gives the president, you know, unusual powers that really weren't intended, you know, by the framers of the Constitution. And I think no matter which party you belong to or which side of the aisle you're on, this is sort of a dangerous thing to have happen. And it seems to be getting worse and worse, if you will. You know, each thing that happens seems to be sort of concentrating power with the executive branch. We're seeing it, you know, we saw it with NDAA, we saw it with NSA, we've seen so many different kinds of things. We see the president having, you know, charged more people with espionage, you know, for leaking, you know, documents that the public should have a right to see anyway, than any other president or all the other presidents combined. So this president seems to be doing an awful lot of, you know, I don't want to say power grabs, but really trying to invest more power in the executive branch than ever before in America's history.
And in fact, that's a point that I've made quite a bit on this program, the fact that this president has done more end runs around Congress, which is one of the reasons that there's a predicament now. Now, fast-tracking, there was some idea that whatever they had worked out as a pact with these nations under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they would have accomplished that mission by the end of this year, and we have 8 days to go for the legislative session to end. So it probably would not happen in this legislative session. But the interesting thing is that when it does come up, it will meet with a formidable opposition, because the oddest thing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that it has coalesced a full spectrum of foes spanning all sides of the political spectrum. They're on every side of it, every part of it. You have conservatives against it, liberals against it, progressives, radicals, unions. Everybody is ganging up and working. Believe it or not, it seems to me, at least from what I'm reading, it seems as if there is a kind of unified effort forming in opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
You're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. One of the things that has been happening, and in fact, they just finished, you know, this process, was that a number of groups were working with members of Congress. Most notably, Representatives George Miller and Rosa DeLauro had a Dear Colleague letter. They'd actually done one version of it in 2012, and then when the trade representative changed, when Ron Kirk resigned and Michael Froman was named this last summer, Representatives DeLauro and Miller then came up with a new letter with some additional information and began collecting signatures of their colleagues in opposition to fast-track authority. 75% of the members of Congress, 151 members out of the 200, signed it, saying, we do not approve of fast-track authority. They also got about a dozen members of the House Ways and Means Committee to draft a letter of their own. It wasn't quite as strongly worded as the DeLauro-Miller letter, but it also said, hey, as you've outlined it, we're not going to approve fast-track authority. In addition, Walter Jones, a Republican, also started a letter, had it signed by Michelle Bachmann and a total of 22 members of the GOP, many of them in the Tea Party caucus, also opposing fast-track authority. And they're just part of the mix. There's about a dozen or so senators that also signed on to a letter that was started by a number of legal scholars around the country. Recently, in response to the intellectual property text that was leaked, and I can talk a little bit more about that, but there's, you know, there are other groups, and, you know, members of the Senate signed their letters. There are groups getting together, you know, our organization, MoveOn.org, our regional organizers all across the country, and 40-plus MoveOn councils got into this fight early on, supporting Public Citizen and Citizens Trade Campaign. A group called Popular Resistance, which is a strong grassroots movement led by Dr. Margaret Flowers and her partner Kevin Zeese. They have a Flush the TPP campaign They're working with a group out here in Washington State called Backbone Campaign. Recently, there were talks held, informal talks, supposedly, and they, I think, called them informal talks so they could keep stakeholders and everyone else out of them. But they were held in Salt Lake City, and in fact, they're just about to wrap up tomorrow because they actually extended them. And some of the trade negotiators met in advance to sort of hammer out some of the fine points that they had problems with prior to going down to Singapore for what is supposed to be the last round of negotiations. It's actually the 20th round of negotiations scheduled for December 7th through 9th of this year. If they do manage to, you know, work something out that, you know, would give Congress like one working week then, because they recess or are supposed to recess as of now on the 13th. So we're sort of keeping our eye on what's going to be happening there. But one of the things that came out of these talks in Salt Lake City, and some folks may have seen it in the news now, is that there's a trade negotiator for the United States named Stan McCoy, who is influencing and overseeing, you know, most of the discussion on prescription medicines and some of the other, you know, more tough sticking points on intellectual property. And the word that we were getting, you know, kind of out of, you know, kind of filtered out of someone who was privy to those negotiations, was that Representative McCoy, you know, who, you know, has been, you know, basically leading these negotiations, has about 20 people working with him. Some of these other countries have maybe one or two negotiators. So one of the tactics that Stan McCoy has been using is to have marathon, round-the-clock negotiating sessions. Reject any proposals that come from other countries and just keep hammering on what the U.S. big pharma and other corporations want in terms of intellectual property guidelines. One of the things that they're talking about doing would really threaten the availability of affordable generic medicine worldwide. I mean, it would affect us here in the United States. It would affect Canada, which has, you know, a state-run healthcare program. It would affect, you know, the global AIDS fight. So there's many, many organizations, Doctors Without Borders, who are up in arms about this. So, you know, there's humanitarian issues at stake here. This isn't just a political fight. There are real humanitarian issues at stake. You know, we can get into, you know, issues of, you know, wanting to patent genes and animals and plants and, you know, privatize water and, you know, GMOs and all kinds of things. I mean, it's just, it's kind of like a Pandora's box of awfulness. It really
Well, we'll be getting into the details of that, exactly what the content is. We just wanted to get people acquainted in a broad way today, and then we'll be coming back. And this is going to be a series, so we'll be talking about it in various aspects as we go. I just wanted to find out from you, how can people get in touch with you to find out what it is that your organization does, and how to learn more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership to prepare, as a matter of fact, for further discussions that we'll be having.
Okay, great. Well, there's a few things that they can do, and I'm also going to mention the names of a couple of key coalition partners, because we're all working together to lead a number of actions. We're working quite a bit on education, for example. I'll give you my email address that anyone can write to me, and I will get some information about what we're doing. We lead calls just about every Sunday, and we have updates on everything that's happening from all the coalition partners, and we also share information on different issues. So I invite people to, you know, get in the loop to get our invites to the Sunday calls. My address is liz.moveon@earthlink.net, liz.moveon@earthlink.net. So folks can write to me, and I'll make sure they get on the list, and we'll keep them updated. We also share everything from all of our organizing partners at other organizations, so they'll be pretty well in the loop if they write to me. We also are working very closely with PDA, and they have created a special page where they're posting most of this stuff also, and it's pdamerica.org/TPP. So pdamerica.org/TPP. and they can find a lot of the things that we're doing there. And there's also an interactive map that will tell them where their member of Congress stands on the issue and stuff. So we'll have action tools as well, including letters to the editor, links to phone numbers where they can call their members of Congress. We'll post actions. During the week of December 2nd through December 9th when the trade talks are happening, there's a number of things going on. December 3rd is actually going to be a global day of action in solidarity with Indonesia, which has called for this because of WTO talks that are happening that day. They're actually doing what's called the Doha, D-O-H-A round of WTO talks in Indonesia on December 3rd. And so our folks decided to make that a global day of solidarity. It's in advance of the last round of PPP talks. So we're encouraging folks to plan rallies or spectacle events. The folks at Backbone Campaign, we can hook you up with them. They have banners and all kinds of things that they'll send you, and they do light projections and a whole variety of things. There's also a really great website called OccuCards, O-C-C-U, Cards, C-A-R-D-S, one word, OccuCards. And, just Google them, OccuCards. They actually have a Creative Commons license. They sell cards on the TPP that you can hand out. It gives you a quick, here's what it is and, all about it in a couple of paragraphs that you can hand them out if you do a rally or something. They sell them at cost. They also have a PDF file that you can download for free and print from, because they're not about making profits. They're about getting the word out. So you have your choice. You can order them printed at cost, or you can print your own if you want to do it that way. So
all right. No, go ahead.
They're a great resource for overall great source for all kinds of information. And I would just encourage people. They've got so much information on the site that you might be intimidated, but park it on your browser, or save it as a bookmark. But Citizens Trade Campaign, you want to visit their site because they have everything collected there.
I think you have given about 500 different ways that people can access information.
That's the thing. There are so many groups involved in this. I mean, I would be happy to keep it simple and say, just connect with me and I'll connect you with all of the coalition partners, because there are groups that are leading the way, producing great materials. Lori Wallach at Public Citizen has been the legal voice behind all of this since the very beginning. She's been fighting toxic trade for 20 years. And, I learned everything I know from her. So I would say that there are so many great people involved in this fight. Margaret Flowers,
right.
Lori Wallach, Tim Carpenter at PDA. And
Liz, we got to go.
Okay.
Because you'll be staying with us about places people can hook up until tomorrow. You did tell us quite a few ways that people can connect, and that would be great. I want to thank you, though, for being with us today, getting this conversation started. We will, of course, be returning to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, just as we have been doing with the Brawley case and with the Detroit bankruptcy and so forth. This is the way we do it, a little bit at a time. So thanks again, Liz, for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Teresa. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I'm here anytime you need me.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to comment about something that happened last week, and that was the pardon in Alabama. The state of Alabama has granted posthumous pardons to three of the Scottsboro boys who were falsely convicted in 1931 of raping two white women. And in a way, the case started what we could probably call the modern upswing in civil rights advocacy. And of course, a lot was made of it. They issued a pardon and said that it's time to put this sad chapter of Alabama's history behind it, and in a way signaling that this was the state's way of making things right and basically responding to humanitarian pleas for justice and all the other good things that people plead for that they never get. So the state has issued these three pardons. And it brought to mind, again, the Central Park young men who were convicted of a vicious rape of a woman in Central Park, as you remember. And a group of them were said to be, quote, wilding, unquote, throughout Central Park and came upon the woman who was jogging and viciously attacked her sexually and physically just beat her into a coma, actually. And the connection between the two is very, very important not to miss. And that is, first, the injustices are done. Horrible trials, incompetent, sometimes incompetent representation, as with the Scottsboro boys, prejudiced juries, segregated society, as it was in Alabama, the predetermined conviction, public outcry, political pressure for conviction. So the predictable outcome finally arrives, and people presented for conviction in the court are thus convicted. And then years and years and years go by, with the Scottsboro since 1931, with the young men in the Central Park case for 13 years, plus 13 years. They had to go through agony, and the city finally decided it will exonerate them. But in both the Scottsboro case and the Central Park case, miraculously, nobody, no prosecutor, no police officer, no detective, no judge has been held responsible. And in the case of Scottsboro, they issue a pardon. Well, you are pardoned when the state refuses to admit guilt or wrongdoing. So what good is a pardon? The proper way would have been complete exoneration, if they were going to do it, and damages to the families who had been deprived of these young men in their midst. In the Central Park case, we have the prosecutor who has gone on to be a professor at Columbia University, continuing to have a rather satisfactory career, professional career. No one has been called to pay the price. Nobody has been prosecuted. And we know in the Central Park case, there is no doubt, as it was with the Scottsboro boys case, that it was a completely corrupt process. Official misconduct to the hilt. And no one pays the price except the people victimized by the system. So keep your pardons. Nothing short of full-fledged exonerations, admissions of guilt and wrongdoing, and produce the wrongdoers and prosecute them. Absolutely. This business of thinking, well, oh, we could just wave a wand and everybody would be satisfied and people will say, well, at last, it only took 400 years to get the justice, and even so, grudgingly given, But this now has to be insisted on in the Central Park case. There's unfinished business there. In the Scottsboro case, I imagine most people are dead and gone. But the Central Park 5 case is still very much alive. And some accounting has to be made as to how it is that you can convict 5 people on specious evidence. Somebody had to make some kind of representation or misrepresentation, to be accurate about it. And the prosecutor had to have known that these were not the young men. Everybody knew. When this case broke, the newspaper that I was editor of, we broke the story. The black press had been reporting that these young men were not at all involved. That was said from the beginning. But they made them pay because Ed Koch, the mayor of the city at the time, insisted, and everybody insisted, that somebody had to be guilty. So go out and find us the people who are guilty. And they came up with, here are a couple of guys, and yeah, we think they did it. And then the process went along to prove that they all did it, knowing full well that the evidence did not suggest that. So the question still remains. Forget the fact that the city of New York has said, well, it will settle. This is not about settling the lawsuits. This is about justice. And justice demands that the prosecutor in this case, who has gone on to have a very nice living at Columbia University, that somebody should be made to account for how it is that this happened. How could this possibly have happened? It really infuriated me to read this business about Alabama saying, oh, well, look, we've exonerated people. Well, we've exonerated them, and you forfeited their lives a long time ago. And here in the city of New York, in this modern day when we can correct something, Elizabeth Lederer, the prosecutor from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who is now on the faculty and earning a living, has yet to be made to explain how she could possibly have prosecuted this case based on the corrupt evidence and down the full chain of command. So the city of New York, the city council of New York, needs to ask that question, and they need to hold hearings, and they need to call the police department and the police commissioner and every accountable individual before a committee asking questions, with the aim of producing indictments, because this is the height of prosecutorial misconduct. And it's still a chance to set things right. Thanks for being with me today. We covered a lot of ground. I hope it meant something to you. You can certainly reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com, and the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. And thanks again so much. We'll see you tomorrow.